That's good. More people here.
See how things go here.
Well, not just tonight. Thou not in my house. It's all in my house, right? Got a house in Berrien here today. They just recently put up on the market. For the last couple of years, we've used it as a rental. And the last few months of it being used as a rental, things didn't go so well, and the house got pretty damaged. And so I want you to, for a moment, imagine that you have a house. Okay? It might not be hard for some of you because you probably already got houses, but I want you to imagine your first house, that this is your house. You own a house. It might not have been the greatest house when you moved into it, but you moved into it with a dream. What this house could be. Fixer-upper when you stepped inside, took your first steps around, and your wife sobbed a little bit because she couldn't stand the look of the house. And you talked her into buying it, and you got in there, and sure enough, day after day, week after week, month after month, you put a little bit of elbow grease into that house, and you started fixing it up. Okay? Your house is starting to look pretty nice. About 5 years down the road, it does look nice. You've got a nice little house. Alright? You spent some time. You tore out a wall that allowed more living space in the living room area. You added a fireplace for comfort and convenience. You remodeled the kitchen. You laid new floors. You remodeled the bathroom. You remodeled every room in the house. You even added a room on the back. Just because you could. So you did. This is a nice house, but it's taken 5 years, all right? So you're looking at your house, and you're looking at your family, and, well, families grow in 5 years. And so you're contemplating on what's going on, and you decide, well, I'm going to have to move on. I've kind of outgrown my house. So you decide to keep your house around for a while. Hence, it becomes a rental. Now, as a rental, the whole goal is to have renters. Probably know that. You want renters if you have a rental. And so, you put your house up as a rental. You're approached by some renters. Now these renters, when they come to you, they say, we would love to live in your house. You've got a nice house. I actually would like to live there. Things haven't been going so well for me lately. Things have been kind of down and out. I'm almost homeless. But if I could live in your house, I'd really appreciate it. I'd start things over again, you know, get on the right track. And I'd bring my whole family here. And well, we'd just really be thankful that you allowed us to live in your house. Well, you have a house for rent. They want to rent a house. So you make an agreement, right? You put a contract together and you say, okay, no problem. Move in. And this is the agreement we make. Things look good. They're moving along. But there's something I've noticed with time that I bet a lot of you have noticed as well. It's a thing called complacency. Okay, I'm sure a lot of people. Okay, so, in the beginning, they're extremely appreciative that they're living in your house. Thank you. A lot of gratefulness going on. Well, as time goes by, it sort of diminishes. They're not as thankful as they once were. And all of a sudden, it's not so much that it's your house as it has become their home. They live there. You're kind of somewhere off in the distance that calls them every now and then or stops by for rent money. But it's their home. This is where they live. Your rules aren't so important anymore. Now, it's kind of whatever works for them. Because they're the ones living there, and they have to go through the day-to-day living in that house. It doesn't usually work out. Okay? And it's not working out in your house. Because see, what you have found out is, as they're creating their own rules or ignoring your rules, well, their lifestyle has become destructive to the house that you put 5 years of work into. And now your house is being beat down. is taking the wear and tear damage of the lifestyles of the people that you let live in your house. Now, this illustration I just painted, the story I told, the one that you've imagined, it could be compared to a few stories out of the Bible. It could be compared to the nothing that was once here, that God took and created this beautiful universe that we have. He made this cute little ball of blue and green with paradise sitting on top of it. And he put Adam and Eve inside that paradise and said, "Hey, you know, you guys, I just made this Garden of Eden for you guys to live in. And I want you to enjoy it. I spent 6 days making this place for you when I could have just kind of snapped my fingers and it would have been there. But I wanted it to be really good. This is paradise." And actually, when God was done creating paradise, he looked at it and he said, "It's good." And when God says something's good, it's good, right? My house and beer is pretty good, but it's nothing compared to God's good, right? This is God's good. And so he said, "Adam and Eve, I want you to move in, and I want you to take care of this place for me. You know what? You can have anything that I have here for you. This is yours. Eat of the fruit, eat of the sour, salt, and the grounds, and enjoy it. Just don't eat fruit that's in the middle of the garden. I don't want you to take part in that. Actually, if you do eat that, you'll end up dying. So don't do it." There was one rule set up for them. Now, I've gone over the story many times, as I'm sure you have as well. And I started thinking about it recently. What was the enticement? What brought them to the fruit in the middle of the garden? We all know that they went there and they ate it. And we know that they were led there by a serpent. But why? I started thinking about complacency. Imagine, if you will, the very first day God set them in the garden and said, "Look at this beautiful place. Look at all this fruit you can enjoy. Enjoy it. It's yours. Just don't eat that one fruit." And as soon as God turns his back and leaves, here comes a serpent walking along and says, "Hey, God's gone now. Why don't we go enjoy some of that fruit?" Can you guys imagine what the response would have been at that point? No way. No. Adam would have turned to him and said, "Well, why would I eat that fruit? God just gave me all these. He gave me oranges, apples, pears, bananas. I got the salad on the ground. I don't need that fruit there in the middle of the garden. You've got to be out of your mind. That's the only thing you told me not to do. I'm not going to do that." And you know what? He would have built a little strength. And it's quite possible he'd be living in the garden still right now, because I got to tell you, as you beat Satan back, you gain strength and you're stronger next time he comes at you. So 10 years later, when Satan would have came at him, he said, "Wait a second, you tried this before. I know I'm not supposed to eat that fruit." But he didn't. The Bible actually says the serpent was a little bit clever. And he was, because he won. He won that battle against Adam and Eve. He said, or he waited. He waited until, I believe, they became complacent. There's only so many times that you can eat an apple before this little bland, you know. He got them, sucked them in with complacency. But I'm not going to compare it to that story. There's another story I can compare it to as well. We've all heard of the Promised Land. Promised Land, flowing with milk and honey. God had his chosen people, his people, the Israelites, and he saved them from Egypt, and he brought them over across the Red Sea. They turned around as the sea closed back up over their enemies. They were freed from slavery. And he made covenant with them. And he gave them a list of commandments and rules, and he said, "Hey, you know what, you guys? I've got a covenant with you. I'm going to take care of you guys, but I need you to follow these rules. They're for your safety and they're for our relationship. So I'm going to give you the Promised Land, but I want you to live like this." Are they in the Promised Land still? Kinda. They definitely lost it. They got ripped right out of their hands because they fell away from God. They fell into the immoral behaviors and attitudes of the people that were around them. They became complacent with a lifestyle that they were set to live with God. And they reached out into the forbidden fruit. Promised Land, the land flowing with milk and honey, was ripped away from wars and from wars within. Now, I could compare it to that story as well, but I'm not, again, even though really I've already compared it to both of those. Really, I'm going to bring it a step closer to home. You guys have a house. You have a house that you've worked on. You have a house that has been built by God's moral character. Okay. Some of you may not know what I'm referring to. You may have an idea of where I'm going. Even if you don't, I'm going to let you in on it right now. This house I'm referring to, it's the United States. Many of us have learned about some of our forefathers of the past, the United States. All through high school, you learn about them in history. They're big figures. One name I'm going to throw out at you, I'm sure that you guys have heard this name before. If you haven't, you need to go back to high school. George Washington. We all know who George Washington was, right? All right. Was he our first president? Actually, he wasn't. I just found that out recently. He kind of was. It was a weird trivia thing there. Technically, yes, but we declared independence in 76, and he didn't take presidency until 81. So there's a guy in the middle there that kind of held that position. But you're right, yeah. He was, for all intents and purposes, George Washington, our very first president, right? Founding father. Is he a Christian? Do you believe in God? Do you try to set up the nation's laws or rules according to what God wanted? Let me tell you something that George Washington is known for saying. George Washington said it is impossible to govern without God and the Bible. Impossible. Can't do it. You need God and the Bible to govern. Where did he come from? You know, he came from the mental state of the oppression from England. They were trying to push down their ideas on the people that they reigned over. They weren't allowed to open up the Bible and believe what they wanted to believe. It was what the king believed, it was what they believed. And George Washington, I don't know. You know, we're going to take the Bible and God's laws, we're going to look at it and understand it, and we're going to use what God's laws are, his moral laws, to build our new country. I'm going to paraphrase a little bit, but I think George Washington said something along these lines to his buddies when he's hanging out with them and he's writing up things that were going to go into law. I think he said, "As for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord." And I think he stole that from Joshua. And I think that it's a good idea that we steal that from Joshua as well. Abraham Lincoln is another founding father. Abraham Lincoln was great. And I found something out too as I'm looking through our founding fathers and all the greatest presidents we've ever had. A lot of them have deep roots in Christianity. That's pretty cool. Abraham Lincoln said, "The only assurance for our nation's safety is to lay our foundation on morality and Christianity." Not just God, it was Christianity. Morality and Christianity. That's the only assurance of our nation's safety. Which is pretty interesting. I've heard something said many times, and I'm sure you guys have too, and I've even heard this said by Christians. I've heard people say that it is not the government's responsibility to legislate morality. Maybe you haven't heard it. But I have. And I heard it recently. It's not the government's job to legislate morality. Now, what exactly does that mean? If you think about that, if you stand back and you kind of analyze what they just said, it really doesn't make any sense at all. It definitely disagrees with what Abraham Lincoln said. He said, we need morality, and that's what we got to use, morality and Christianity. Right? He two-stepped things, and I'm doing both of those. But there's more to it than that. All right? There's more to it than just morality. With Christianity as well. I'm going to give you four reasons why we know, just with the idea of legislating morality, that we should. And you guys will probably add four more. Ten more. You're going to think of 100 more, I guarantee it, because it's so obvious. Drunk driving, rape, molestation, murder. Four quick reasons why the government should legislate morality. Those are all moral issues. If the government didn't legislate morality, these people that want to commit these acts would just run rampant. The government would have nothing to do with it. The government's responsibility, I think, in everyone's knowledge, is to protect its people. Why else would we have a government? Why would we give them our taxes? except for to set up a protection for us. They're not only meant to protect us from the outside world, what is beyond our borders, but they're also to protect us from the people that are within our borders. I know that, as far as I'm concerned, and many of you are as well, that I wouldn't want to be hit by a drunk driver, raped or molested, or murdered any more than I want my plane to be shot down by a terrorist. And as a matter of fact, I would rather have my plane shot down by a terrorist than a couple of those things I mentioned. Just the way it is. The government is there to legislate morality because they need to protect us. What Abraham Lincoln said was true. The only assurance that we can have for our nation's safety is to lay our foundation in morality and in Christianity. So if you would, please turn with me to Revelation chapter 3. In Revelation, I'm actually going to tell you a little story about a city named Sardis. Pretty interesting. We're going to go 3:1. Okay. And to the angel of the church of Sardis, write, he who has the seven spirits of God and the seven stars says this. I don't know if I have to give background here. Some of you may not have your Bibles. Jesus is talking to John in a vision. And he's telling John, hey, I want you to write this down and I want you to send it to or your person as the angel of the church of Sardis. Probably if it's an angel, Jesus could talk to himself. John more likely is going to write it on paper and send it to some of the leaders over there in Sardis. I want you to write this. I know your deeds, that you have a name, that you are alive, but you're dead. That means so much more than what you can understand by this reading. The people that read that, that lived in Sardis, knew exactly what Jesus was referring to. That. And if you don't ever look into the history of Sardis, you won't know. So I'm going to tell you what this means. And I want, as you guys are listening, what I want is for you to picture Sardis. And I want you to compare the people of Sardis and the attitude of Sardis to the attitude and country that we live in here today. Sardis, 500 years before this was written, was one of the world's richest cities, most powerful cities. It was huge. It just happened to be positioned right, and it had the right natural resources in the area. It just, that's what happened back then. If you were on the right path, you know, everyone walked through your area, you were big. You had a lot of commerce. Sardis grew, and it was huge. So Sardis, the inhabitants of Sardis, became a little bit arrogant. They were definitely prideful and boastful because they came from the great city, Sardis. You want to be able to tell your friends when you're visiting them when we're in some lame city that you were from Sardis because that was a position of power. You were from Sardis. So Jesus tells them, I know your deeds, that you have a name that you are alive, but you are dead. In AD 17, an earthquake struck. Sardis was destroyed. The Roman Empire was there, and the Roman Empire came in and said, well, you know what, this is a great city. We don't want it to be completely destroyed, and so they started to rebuild it. It was only a fraction of its former glory after the Roman soldiers came in and rebuilt that city. Only a fraction. But you know what? The people that still lived in Sardis, they still live that arrogant, boastful lifestyle as if they lived in the great city of Sardis. And Jesus is telling these guys, hey, I know your deeds, and I know that you have a name that you are alive, but you are dead. Sardis used to be great. It used to be a great city. But it's not anymore. Come back down to reality a little bit, and let's live with what you've got right now. And he's using the idea of Sardis to compare it to the Christians that are living there, because they're doing the same thing. You guys have a great Christian name, but, you know, you're not alive. You're dead. We need to revitalize something here. And he says, in the next verse he goes on, wake up and strengthen the things that remain, which were about to die, for I have not found your deeds completed in the sight of my God. Wake up and strengthen the things that remain. Sardis is only partially rebuilt. And Jesus is saying, hey, you know what? Partially rebuilt. And you guys are looking as if you have the whole city still. I want you to take what you have there. Take what remains, and I want you to work with that and strengthen it. I want what you have to grow. I don't want you to pretend like you're still this big wig that's got everything. I want you to take what you have and use it to grow. Strengthen that. Again, comparing to their Christian lifestyle. For I have not found your deeds completed in the sight of my God. They stopped. They didn't finish building. The deeds were incomplete. Remember, therefore, what you have received and heard, and keep it, and repent. If therefore you will not wake up, I will come like a thief, and you will not know at what hour I will come to you. The Titanic. Everyone's familiar with the Titanic, right? I'm going to bring this up and you're going to know why in a minute. The Titanic was a great ship, right? But it hit an iceberg and it started to sink. Well, you know what they have in great ships? I think they have them in every ship except maybe little fishing boats. They have a little control center. And in that control center, they got a guy that says, "Help, our ship's sinking." Right? And he sends out their signal. And he sends it across the airways for anybody that can hear to hear, because the ship's sinking. And if nobody comes, everyone's going to drown. We know what happened with the Titanic. It really happens. If nobody comes, you drown. Guess what? Everybody knows about the Titanic. I'm not sure if everybody knows about the California. Maybe you do. Maybe just I didn't. There's a boat called the California. Californian, 5 to 10 miles at most away from the Titanic as it was sinking. The Californian as well had a control center set up so it could send out messages in case it was sinking, and it could also receive messages in case there were any other boats in the surrounding area that were in distress. Well, in the Californian, we had a man in charge of the control center. The man was sleeping as the distress signals came in. He slept through the sinking of the Titanic. Now, the California was large enough and fast enough to make it to the Titanic within enough time to save nearly every passenger that was aboard. But he was sleeping. And because he was sleeping, most of those passengers perished. Remember, therefore, what you have received and heard, and keep it and repent. And therefore, you will not wake up, I will come like a thief, and you will not know at what hour I will come. There are people out there thinking around us, sending out signals. Help, they're sinking. Save us. We're not on call to be asleep at the control center. There's a couple stories or parables that come to mind. One of which is this. God gave out a few talents to a few different people. Okay? First guy, he gave me talents, and the guy went out and he spread those talents out and he invested them and he got a whole bunch of talents back. He gave those back to God. Then God gave another guy some talents. Not as many, but that guy went out and he used those talents to gain more talents and he brought them back to God. This is what I'm afraid of. I'm afraid of the third guy. The guy who's asleep at the wheel. I'm afraid of the many Christians that are asleep at the wheel. Control. A lot of Christians think they need to separate themselves completely from the world. That they want to hide themselves in the corner and not be corrupted by everything that's going on around them. They want to sit at their own end of the lunch table so they don't have to talk with the other people that are at the lunch table and be influenced by the conversations that they're having. They're hiding themselves asleep. You know what the third guy did with his talent? He took it out and buried it in the ground. God wasn't very happy about that. He brought it back to God and said, "God, I know how much you appreciate your talents. I know you didn't want to lose it, so I buried it in the ground." He said, "Hey, you know what? If you would have just invested that talent, I could have had more talents along with that." And he took that talent away from that guy and he gave it to someone else. We're not called to hide ourselves in a corner. We're not called to bury our talents. An easy reference to this is a couple symbols that Christ gives us personally. We're called to be lights. We're called to be a light on a hill. Anybody here ever buried a light under a bowl? No, probably. Me neither. Lampshade. Jesus says not to do it, though. Either don't bury your light under a bowl, and no one's going to see it. My question to you is this. As a light, if you indeed are a light, are you meant to be a follower or a leader? Because I think if you're following behind everybody else, no one's going to see you. They're not going to know where to go. They're still walking in the darkness. Another point is this. Another one that Jesus brings up. And I started off by talking about sodium. Sodium is an element that in nature is never found to be by itself. Never. Sodium bonds with whatever elements are around it. Pretty interesting. There's another element called chlorine. Chlorine is almost the opposite. It's very destructive. Chlorine's out there in nature destroying everything that's around it. It's poisonous. It's a destroyer. Sodium, when mixed with chlorine, when bonded with chlorine, becomes sodium chloride, common table salt. Aren't we called to be salt? Called to be salt of the world. Not only did Jesus bond with us, turn us into the salt, but we are to bond with others. We are now the sodium that's to go out in the world and to bond ourselves to them and turn them from the destructive power into the constructive power that they can become, just like we became through Jesus. We're supposed to be builders and not destroyers. We're not supposed to hide ourselves away from the world. We're supposed to go out into the world and save it. Salt. Another interesting thing about salt is that salt is a preservative for rotting meat, which I think many of you will agree, much of the world could be compared to rotting meat. So what does this all mean? What does it mean if we can do this? If we can indeed go out to the world and bond ourselves and be the influence towards the coin that's out there. Verse 5 reads, "He who overcomes shall thus be clothed in white garments, and I will now erase his name from the book of life, and I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches." This is it, you guys. This is the idea. Not in my house. We started out a Christian nation. And then we went somewhere along the lines, I don't know where it is, but we went and we hit ourselves and we let the ACLU take over. Now it's their nation. They're saying, hey, you know what? If you even start talking about God, we're going to take you to court, and everybody's afraid of it. But it's a Christian nation, and it was founded on God's moral laws. Not man's. Not what man thinks. It's founded on God's moral laws. Start talking about Sardis and the name and the great name that it once had, and I want you to think in ourselves or as ourselves in the same way. As Christians, we don't want to be like the Sardisians, right? I think we understand that. As a matter of fact, let me tell you what happened to them. About 20 years after this letter was written, they fell into sexual immorality. The church was barely even there. Only 20 years after they received a letter personally from the Apostle John. I see our country following that same path. They lived as if they had a great name, but Jesus knew they were dead. This is what I want for us as a nation of Christians. I don't want us to live to the world saying, hey, you guys, Christianity used to be so great. Remember how great Christianity was. I want us to live to the world showing them how great Christianity is. Christianity is great. And if we can do that, then we will overcome. We'll be clothed in white garments. Our name will not be blotted from the book of life. And we'll be able to bond ourselves to others and bring them in as well.